Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Was Jesus misquoted? Dr. Bart Ehrman will explore that topic in a lecture he'll be presenting at MTSU on February 18th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building. Dr. Ehrman is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor at the University of North Carolina and the author of more than 20 books, including Misquoting Jesus, Jesus Interrupted, and God's Problem. He'll sign his books following his talk. His lecture, which is free and open to the public, is part of the annual Philosophy Lyceum here on campus, and we welcome Dr. Ehrman by phone from Chapel Hill. Good morning, sir.
Morning.
The subtitle of your book, Misquoting Jesus, is Scribes Who, or not the subtitle of your book, I should say, what the Philosophy Lyceum has subtitled the lecture, Scribes Who Changed the Bible and Readers Who Will Never Know. Who are these scribes, and what did they change in the Bible?
Yes, right. That's exactly what I'll be talking about. So what a lot of people don't realize is that when we're dealing with ancient books like the New Testament, the books of the New Testament, we don't have the original copies that the authors wrote. So that, for example, when the Apostle Paul wrote a letter that's in the New Testament, like the letter to the Galatians, we don't have his actual copy that he wrote. And we don't have a copy of the copy or a copy of the copy of the copy, and so on. We have copies that were made centuries later by hand, since in the ancient world, of course, that was the only way to copy a book. And so what we have lots of copies of the books of the New Testament from the Middle Ages. Most of these copies are many centuries after the originals, and all of them have changed the originals. And so there are places where scholars debate what the originals said, and there are some places where, in fact, we don't know what the originals said.
Can you point out some specific instances of places in the Bible where differing accounts of the same thing seem to be contradictory?
Well, you know, there's a contradiction whenever you have an account in some manuscripts that's not found in other manuscripts. One of the most famous examples, for example, comes from the Gospel of John. I think maybe the most famous story about Jesus in the entire New Testament is in John chapter 7 and 8, where the Jewish authorities drag a woman in front of Jesus, and they say to him that she's been caught in the act of adultery, and they want to know whether they should stone her to death or not, because that's what the law of Moses commands. And so they're setting a trap for Jesus, because if he says, that's what Moses says, so go ahead and stone her, then he's breaking his teachings of love and forgiveness. But if he says, no, forgive her, then he's breaking the law of Moses. But if he says, go ahead and stone her, so what's he supposed to do? And so he stoops down on the ground and starts to write, and looks up and says, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. And one by one they begin to leave because they're embarrassed by their own sins, until there's no one left but the woman. And Jesus looks up and says, is there no one left to condemn you? And she says, no, Lord, no one. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. So this is a wonderful story about Jesus getting off the hook of a trap, and also a story about forgiveness of sins. And as I said, it's a very popular story. It's in all the Jesus movies. But the reality is it was not originally in the Gospel of John. In fact, it wasn't originally in the New Testament at all. It was added later by scribes. And we know this because we have early manuscripts of the New Testament that don't have the story. And there are lots of other reasons for knowing it. But the reality is that this is a change made by scribes in which they added this interesting story.
We have to point out that in the Middle Ages, before Gutenberg invented movable type, that the Bible was rewritten time and time again. I mean, literally copied by hand, and it took them a long, long time to do it. And before Gutenberg, also, only the elites had access to literature, to books of any kind. And so they would do this with pen and ink, and sometimes, I take it, they would make mistakes, they'd get tired, they'd get sloppy. Is there any scholarship to indicate that anybody deliberately changed or altered a prior edition of the Bible for ideological reasons?
The answer is absolutely yes, and you're completely right that before there's any mechanical means of producing a book, before Gutenberg invents the printing press with movable type, everything had to be copied by hand. And whenever anybody copies something by hand, they naturally make mistakes. They just accidentally will leave out a word or leave out a line or change a word or misread a word, and so accidents get made. But there are also intentional changes to the text where a scribe will modify the text because it doesn't say what he thinks it ought to say, or it doesn't say what he thinks it really means. And so, I mean, this woman, the story of the woman taken in adultery is an example. Whoever added that story to the Gospel of John didn't do it by accident. I mean, it wasn't a slip of the pen. It was somebody who thought the story should belong in the Gospel of John. Maybe it's because the person thought that he wanted Jesus to be shown as forgiving one of the most heinous sins that the scribe could imagine, and so, you know, for that reason, to show a more forgiving Jesus, he inserted the story.
Where did the story come from? Did he make it up out of whole cloth, or was it in some sort of other ancient text that was separate from what became known as the Bible, and he just felt that it would be okay to cut and paste, or the medieval version thereof?
Well, yes, right. It's a really interesting question that scholars have long debated where the story came from. There are some scholars who want to argue that even though it wasn't originally in John, that it was a story that actually happened, that that was circulating in the oral tradition about Jesus that a later scribe heard. I think it's more likely that, I think it's really difficult to say whether, you know, that it actually happened, but I think certainly it's a story that was floating around being told by word of mouth until somebody wrote it down. And so it may have been circulating for several centuries, but it's, I think it clearly was not in the wasn't in the Gospel of John originally, and I think it's doubtful that it's something that actually happened.
Now, if the text could be altered for ideological reasons, and it could be altered due to human error, it causes me to wonder also how much got lost in the translations through Greek, Aramaic, and other languages.
Well, yes, no, that's a really important point. And one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that when they're reading the Bible, people, of course, are reading an English translation of the Bible, that the English translation was produced by scholars who know Greek and have translated the original Greek of the New Testament into English. And something, of course, always gets lost in translation. But more than that, the teachings of Jesus were not delivered in Greek. When Jesus taught, his native language was Aramaic. And so the Greek New Testament that is at the basis of our English translations is, for the gospel sayings of Jesus, it's a translation out of Aramaic. And so we're getting it more or less third hand, and something obviously gets lost in translation at both steps.
Are there also discrepancies in the Old Testament?
Well, as it turns out, the Old Testament is even a bigger problem. With the New Testament, we have the benefit of having many thousands of manuscripts from the Middle Ages of the Greek New Testament. So that's the good news. I mean, the bad news is that none of these manuscripts is very close in time to the original. With the Hebrew Bible, though, the Christian Old Testament, we're in much worse shape because until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest manuscript we had dated from the year 1000. And so it was, it was 1,500 years after the originals were made, or more for some of the books. And so we have century after century after century of copying going on, in which changes are being made. And we don't have any record of it because we don't have any manuscripts.
What feedback have you received from scholars, Jewish scholars, whose area of expertise is more specifically Judaism, especially vis-a-vis the Torah?
Well, one of the differences that I pointed out is that, you know, we don't have manuscripts. The other difference is that Jewish scribes in the Middle Ages were more highly conscientious of not changing the text than the Christian scribes were. The reason we know this is because we can look at the few Hebrew manuscripts that survive of the Hebrew Bible, and they are much closer to one another than the Christian manuscripts of the New Testament. One of the odd things about the New Testament manuscripts is that we have about 5,600 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, some of them just very small fragments, but some of them entire manuscripts, and no two of those are exactly alike in all their wording, except for the smallest fragments, so that Christian scribes are changing the text a lot. It looks like Jewish scribes, at least in the Middle Ages, were very scrupulous and hardly ever changed their text. And so Jewish scholars tend to think that this sort of thing it's obviously important for the early stages of the copying of the Hebrew Bible, but by the time you get to the Middle Ages, it's not as big of a problem.
So does it in any way alter the way they look at their faith, the way that it might shake a fundamentalist Christian who believes that the Bible is THE, Word of God, verbatim, no alterations?
Right. Well, there's a real problem with that Christian point of view, which is that if the Bible is supposed to have the very words of God, and we don't have those words in places, then what does it even mean to say that we have the words of God? I mean, there are places where we don't have them. Most Jewish most Jews don't look upon the Bible the way that fundamentalist Christians do, as an inerrant revelation from God. And so I think the kinds of problems that you get with Christian fundamentalists when they're confronted with this sort of information, most Jewish people don't have that problem at all.
Are there also any discrepancies with regard to miracles? Now, I know some Christians regard the miracles, the supernatural activities, the burning bush, raising people from the dead, walking on water, as things that are more mythical and parable-like, that have worthwhile lessons to teach, but they don't necessarily believe they actually physically happened. Are there any discrepancies in the reporting, for lack of a better way of putting it, or chronicling of these activities?
Yeah, so this gets into a different area. What I'll be talking about at the lecture is how these scribes have modified the text over the years. But suppose in theory we could establish accurately what the originals said. We then have another problem, which in some ways is unrelated to the problem with the scribes changing the text. But even if we did have the originals, we have the problem that between different accounts of the events described in the Bible, we have discrepancies. Anyone can see this for themselves. All they need to do, for example, is to read the stories of Jesus being raised from the dead in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Read carefully what Matthew says, then compare it carefully with what Mark says, what Luke says, what John says. And you will find that there are many, many differences, but there are also some differences that are virtually impossible to reconcile. In fact, I would say are impossible to reconcile. And that's just with the resurrection account. I mean, it's true with virtually all the stories in the Gospels that we have different accounts, and sometimes they're irreconcilably different.
It may very well be the Word of God, but if the Word of God is being passed down through the oral tradition and written and rewritten and rewritten over the centuries, that is an act of man, not an act of God, and man, as we all know, is fallible.
Yes, well, man is fallible. Woman is fallible. We're all fallible, and scribes are fallible. And so, when I started out in this kind of study, I was actually myself a very conservative evangelical Christian who believed that the Bible gave us the very words of God. But I got to a point where I had trouble believing that anymore, because what I thought was that God had done a miracle in inspiring the writers to write the very words that he wanted them to write. But then I realized that, in fact, that the words that they wrote had not been preserved. And it would be no more of a miracle for God to preserve the words that he inspired in the first place than it would have been to inspire them. But I knew he hadn't preserved the words because we didn't have them. And so it made me question, well, why should I think he inspired them in the first place if I know that he didn't preserve them?
Was there one particular tipping point in your personal experience?
There was. I mean, there were several. One was that realization that since God didn't preserve the words, I had no reason to think he inspired them in the first place. But another tipping point for me was somewhat related. I was at the Princeton Theological Seminary doing a master's degree, and I was taking a course that was an entire semester class studying the Gospel of Mark in the original Greek language, and we had to write a term paper. And so I wrote a 35-page term paper on the question a question that rises in Mark chapter 2. It's a story where Jesus' disciples are going through the grain fields, and they're on the Sabbath day, and they're eating the grain because they're hungry. And their opponents get upset, and the opponents ask Jesus, "Why are your disciples eating the grain on Sabbath? They're not supposed to be harvesting food on the Sabbath." And Jesus says, "Well, don't you remember what David did when Abiathar was the high priest, how he went into the temple and ate the showbread that only the priests are supposed to eat?" And he concludes that, you know, Sabbath was made for humans, not humans for Sabbath. And so it's okay to work on the Sabbath and under some conditions. Well, the thing about that story is that when you read the Old Testament passage where that event's being described, it turns out Abiathar is not the high priest. His father, Ahimelech, was the high priest. It's quite clearly stated in the Old Testament. So I wrote this paper on this passage, as an evangelical Christian, trying to explain, based on my study of the Greek, why, for complicated grammatical reasons, even though it seemed to say that Abiathar was the high priest, it didn't really mean that Abiathar was the high priest. And so I spent 35 pages developing this complicated argument so that there wouldn't be a mistake in the text anymore. And my professor really liked the paper. He gave me an A on it. But at the bottom of it, he wrote a simple comment, which was, "Maybe Mark made a mistake." And I thought about it. I realized, yeah, well, maybe that's it. That's the easier explanation. It's simply, it's just a mistake. And once I realized that there were mistakes, I started seeing them. And once you start seeing them, it turns out they're everywhere.
I don't mean to pose this question as though you were an Islamic scholar, but if these discrepancies could appear in the Bible, are there similar discrepancies in the Quran?
Well, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I unfortunately am not an expert in the Quran. What scholars who are experts in the Quran tell me is that that the text of the Quran is far more stable, much more like the Hebrew Bible was through the Middle Ages, but that it's very difficult to document the earliest stages of the copying of the Quran. Again, as I said, I'm not an Arabic scholar, and I don't really know the ins and outs of Quranic scholarship.
Let's go back to how a Christian, any Christian, let alone a fundamentalist Christian, deals with this type of information, especially when their upbringing, depending upon how devout their parents are, has not prepared them to absorb this or accept this information and to process it very well. This is not something that necessarily has to shake a person's faith down to the bone, is it?
I think it should shake a fundamentalist's faith in the belief that the Bible is without error. But I don't think that it should shake somebody's faith as a Christian. There are lots of ways of being Christian, and fundamentalism is only one very narrow way of being Christian. I have lots and lots of friends who are scholars of the New Testament. Almost all of them consider themselves Christian. Many of them are theologians, and they have no trouble with this information at all. They simply don't think that the Bible contains the very words that God dictated to the authors. They think the Bible might be the Word of God in some sense, but in a more sophisticated sense. And so I don't see this kind of historical scholarship as being anti-Christian at all. I think that learning this information can only make somebody a more knowledgeable Christian. And, you know, the opposite of being a knowledgeable believer is being an ignorant believer. And, you know, who wants to be ignorant? So I think this kind of information is important precisely for believers.
Let's talk about the Bible as it depicts Jesus in different ways. Different believers think that Jesus was as much a human as he was the Son of God. And other believers think that he was a totally divine being. Are there parts of the Bible that depict Jesus in contradictory ways with regard to this characterization of him?
Well, you know, it's been an issue long-standing within Christianity how to understand Jesus. The Orthodox doctrine that developed is that, of course, the one you stated, that Jesus is completely human and he's completely divine at the same time. And theologians have always expressed this as a mystery that can't be fully understood because, of course, I mean, you know, if he is fully God, then how is he fully man, et cetera. And over the ages, there have been people who said that Jesus is man, but he's not God, and others have said he's God, but he's not man, and others have tried to figure out ways that he could be both at once. And different people on different sides of this equation can argue from different passages of the Bible. It's quite clear in the Gospel of John that in some sense Jesus is a divine being. He says, I and the Father are one, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. But all of these statements about Jesus being divine are found in the Gospel of John and only in the Gospel of John. If you were to read the Gospel of Matthew, and that was the only thing you ever knew about Jesus, no way would you think that Jesus was God. You would certainly think that he's the Messiah and that he's God's special chosen one, God's son, but that he's very, very human. And so what happened is when both Matthew and John were put into the Bible, then you had grounds for saying that, well, he's completely human, as in Matthew, and he's completely divine, as in John, and so you get the Orthodox doctrine.
And this, too, is a result of medieval scribes inserting their own spin on Jesus, if you will, into the text of the Bible?
Well, that certainly happened too. You know, there's no place in the Bible that explicitly teaches the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity, which says that there are three persons in the Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and these three are one, except for a passage in the book of 1 John, chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, which says explicitly that there are three in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these three are one. It turns out this passage that's known from the King James Bible is not found in any of the early manuscripts of 1 John. It's not found in any of the medieval manuscripts of 1 John until you get to about the 14th century. And so for many, many centuries, there were no Bibles that had this in the Greek New Testament. But the Greek manuscripts translated by the King James translators, there was a manuscript that happened to have this verse in it, and so it found its way into the King James Bible. So it's an instance in which a scribe in the late Middle Ages put his own Trinitarian belief into a text of the Bible that wasn't originally there.
Is the Revised Standard Version of the Bible an attempt to clear up what some scholars, biblical scholars, believe to be discrepancies in the King James Bible?
The all modern translations today, including the Revised Standard Version, the New Revised Standard Version, the New International Version, et cetera, are done by translators who know full well all of these problems that I've been discussing. What scholars who translate the Bible try to do is not, they don't try to reconcile the discrepancies between the Gospels unless they have a theological reason for doing so. I mean, sometimes you'll have a translator who will sort of play fast and loose with the Greek in order to get rid of a discrepancy, but usually that doesn't happen, you know, especially with the reputable translations. What they do, though, is they're very concerned with getting back to the original writings as best they can. Now, there are places where they can't do it because we simply don't know in some places, and there are a lot of places where scholars argue back and forth whether the verse should read this way or that way, what the original Greek should say. So all translators deal with that problem, but most translators don't deal with the problem of discrepancies, because if the discrepancy is there in the original Greek, they feel like they need to leave it there.
I understand that there are some ancient texts that depict Jesus as having a bit more of a temper than he is depicted in some other text. I mean, according to them, him throwing the money changers out of the temple wasn't the only time he got pissed off.
Yes, no, that's right. So there's this famous story in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, where a leper comes up to Jesus. This fellow has leprosy, and he asks Jesus to heal him. And in most Bibles it says, feeling compassion for the man, Jesus reached out his hand and healed him. But in some of our ancient manuscripts, instead of saying feeling compassion for the man, it says, and getting angry, Jesus reached out his hand and healed him. Well, it's very interesting. You know, why would you have getting angry? And what's more, I mean, how do you decide which the text originally said? Did it originally say that Jesus felt compassion, and some scribes changed it to say he got angry? Or did it originally say he got angry, and some scribes changed it to say he felt compassion? And when you put it like that, it seems pretty obvious that scribes would be more likely to change it to say he felt compassion, because then you get rid of a problem. Scribes are unlikely to create the problem by changing it to say he got angry. So that would suggest that the original reading said that he felt anger. And so in many translations, you'll see a footnote that indicates that older versions sometimes say that Jesus at this point got angry.
A tough love for one's children notwithstanding, it's hard to imagine one feeling anger and compassion at the same time.
Yeah, some scholars have tried to argue that these two words mean the same thing, but you know, I point out that when my wife is acting lovingly toward me, it's quite clear to me that she's not feeling angry at me, and vice versa.
So this is the difference between Jesus as he is depicted in some text as the sweet and loving shepherd who would never raise his hand to anyone and never hurt a fly, and as the hippies in the 60s found him to be the original pacifist.
Yes. Well, one of the exercises I use with my students is to have them read Mark chapters 1 through 6 and bracket everything they've ever read or heard about Jesus and just read Mark chapters 1 through 6 and ask themselves how Jesus is being portrayed in these chapters. And one thing they're very surprised to find is how frequently Jesus gets angry here. And there's not a word about him feeling compassionate. So it's a very interesting exercise, and it shows that each of these gospel writers actually has something distinctive to say, if we'll just let the writer say it instead of pretending that all the writers are saying the same thing.
Well, just to throw another monkey wrench into the mix here, where do the Gnostic Gospels, which were written in the 2nd to 4th century A.D., fit into this picture?
Well, it's very interesting because the Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each act, as I was just trying to say, have a distinctive emphasis on who Jesus was. They don't all say the same thing. And when you throw the Gnostic Gospels into the mix, things get really messed up, because the way the Gnostics portrayed Jesus was so different from the way that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John portray him. For one thing, the Gnostic Gospels don't think that what matters for salvation is the death of Jesus, which brings a sacrifice for sins. For many of the Gnostics, Jesus' significance is that he taught secret teachings that have to be understood. And if you understand his secret teachings, then you'll have salvation. And so it's not based on Jesus' death and resurrection. It's based on the secret mysteries that he reveals. And these Gnostics were the only ones who understood these mysteries. So that's a very different portrayal of Jesus.
The whole thing reminds me of the Mel Brooks' movie, History of the World, Part 1, in which Moses came down from Mount Sinai with three different tablets and said, I have here these 15, and then he drops a tablet and it breaks, and he says, oops, I have here these 10 commandments.
Yes, right. And of course, in the even in the biblical version, he gets ticked off and throws down the 10. He has to go back up and get another set.
Well, Dr. Bart Ehrman is going to be elaborating more on this subject of misquoting Jesus when he speaks as part of our Department of Philosophy Lyceum here on campus on February the 18th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building. Dr. Ehrman is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor at the University of North Carolina. And this lecture is free and open to the public. Come one, come all. You'll find it to be a very enlightening experience. And Dr. Ehrman, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be our guest this morning on MTSU on the Record.
Well, thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.